Today's episode is brought to you by Omio. Omio is a travel booking platform that makes planning a journey in Europe and North America effortless. Just enter your travel details and Omio will magically give you all the train, bus, flight, and ferry options for your journey. It's never been simpler for you to book your first real vacation for 2021. Vacations, remember those? Best of all, using Omio saves you time and money, and that's a win-win in our books. Omio wants to help you leave your house, that's right, leave your house for a change this summer by offering 5% off your next booking. Just head to omio.com and use the code LISTENER5, LISTENER, and the number 5 at checkout. It's valid until June 30th for new users on all modes of transportation. It's just the pick-me-up 2021 needs. Omio, plan, book, and love the journey. Terms and conditions apply.
Juneteenth is a deeply emotional moment for enslaved people because for decades, for centuries, enslaved people prayed for, hoped for, fought for in the form of slave rebellions, running away, bought their freedom when they could. And if you read slave narratives, if you listen to spirituals from the era of slavery, you know that enslaved people longed for freedom. This was something that had been hoped for, but many believe may never come.
Daddy, Mortar is from us too. To give me $40 a month in bed. Well, lots of the boys say they ain't want it. They'd rather go free, you know.
Being able to go wherever they wanted, being able to wander about. For enslaved people, it was an expression of their freedom.
Well, Matt Porter was the one that long Miss Porter, one of our white folks' neighbors. He's come along. We all sitting on the fence, and a colored soldier come along and asked her, did she want to go with him? And she said, yes, she might have one of them horses. She went on with them. I never did see her and hear tell of her no more.
When I think about Juneteenth, I think about it in the context of Emancipation Day celebrations that began January 1, 1863. They took on a whole new meaning when slavery was formally abolished after 1865. You would have had African-American veterans who fought in the Civil War be prominent in these celebrations, dressed in their military garb, speeches from enslaved people, the most prominent Black politicians singing of hymns, spirituals, discussions of registering to vote. Enslaved people celebrating in public their newfound freedom was an act of resistance. Because we have to remember, slavery came to an end after a 4 years bloody, bloody civil war. Still the bloodiest conflict in American history. Many people in the South and in the nation who did not want to see slavery abolished, fought tooth and nail to block the 13th Amendment. The abolition of slavery created a huge humanitarian crisis in the South. Suddenly, 4 million people have very little means to take care of themselves, to support themselves, and do so in a really, really hostile environment. So the military was necessary to make sure that enslaved people got the food, the medicine, the shelter that they needed in order to survive. They're also there to protect, to the extent that that was possible, freed people from violence, from recriminations from slaveholders, from Confederates who still hadn't given up the fight.
And I remember, and the Yankees stopped here, and the Yankees stopped right on the corner of the square, and the first people, you know,
we go to the ground team, and they take them, hang them up with a stone. That's the punishment they got. Next time you see, they come a whole troop of Yankees, all riding horses, big guns hanging on. I said, Mama, where are they going? They're all going home now.
When the last federal troops leave the South, it's a signal to Southerners. The federal government wasn't going to put its might into ensuring the civil rights of Black people would be observed. You have 20, 30 years later, Black people being lynched in public, and there isn't a federal anti-lynching law to protect them. In most communities in America, there's a history of lynching and racial violence. And very few communities have marked that, commemorated that. Every decade since the end of slavery, Black people have been more educated, accrued more wealth, more status in American society. Every decade since 1865. But there's been one constant, and that constant is the presence of random racist violence. What I see in George Floyd's murder was a white police officer attempting to dominate and to subdue a Black man who was not resisting, who could not resist. Even though slavery came to an end in 1865, the desire to master and dominate Black bodies did not. And we have never dealt with that. These are the kinds of stark realities that are highlighted during Juneteenth. If Black people's lives can be expunged through racist violence and no one is held accountable, how free are we? Are we free?
Hello, welcome to another edition of the podcast. Usually I come on here with, special guests, and I'm not nervous. I sort of control the atmosphere and the environment, and you all say I do a good job. But today won't be that day because today's a very intimidating day for me here because I got somebody here who you're going to love. But before I get to that, I just want to remind all of you about some of our sponsors. If you're going to be traveling in the month of June and you're going to be using a website to get your flights, go down to our show notes in the description and use that code for all of our listeners, whether you're a Cubs employee or just somebody on the street that happens to find the podcast. Why pay full price for your summer travel when you can get a discount on any flight from United or Southwest or whatever? So make sure you go down to the description. Also, we're giving away tons and tons of Cub tickets on the podcast all summer long. So if you complain that you couldn't afford Cubs tickets or your family members are asking for Cub tickets, tell them to tune into the podcast and win some Cubs tickets. And then lastly, every Friday is Fanatics Friday, and we give away jerseys and hats and all that kind of good stuff. So if you want all those things, just check out the podcast. And, you know, we're the podcast that gives away tons of free stuff. So I'm not going to stall any longer. Let me get this out of the way. As you all can tell, I'm rocking, so I'm kind of nervous. So, but I have met this person years ago with my youth program at Mars Hill Baptist Church. And, I have moved, I got busier with the Cubs not so much with the youth anymore. So we sort of, you know, disconnected. And I saw he's at a Cubs game. I'm like, wait a minute, he's at a Cubs game and I work here. And I've been following him though ever since, just doing great things. You know, some people are born with those names that you just know when they get older, that name is going to be synonymous with something that is amazing. He's everything I wish I could be. And I'm excited to introduce him to all of you that are listening today. And that is Jedediah Brown. Jedediah, how are you?
Frank, you're too kind. That was a lot. That definitely was an amazing introduction. I'm glad to be on the show with you.
So before I get going with my questions here for you, you are no longer in Chicago, right?
So I have a home, I still have a house in Chicago, but for the last year, I've been traveling and I have dual residence at three different states.
And where is that at?
So it's going to be Miami, Florida. I'm still in Chicago, Illinois, and I'm in Atlanta, Georgia.
You went south. Now, is that because of the snow or just, you know?
I definitely do not miss the snow. the snow is not the top of my list that I got to get back to. But, you know, honestly, I wanted to come to another place where I felt like Black people were, and I was hearing that they were thriving, and that's Atlanta. And then coming to Atlanta, I realized that Miami isn't too far, and the beaches are always beautiful here, which is where I'm at now in Miami, Florida. So I also got a place in Miami. Sort of happened organically. And I'm now trying to get a home in LA and or New York.
Okay. Now I'm excited because so this episode is airing on Juneteenth. So obviously our conversations today, for those that are listening, are going to be about cultural things. But I want to go way back real quick to see. You probably don't remember this because you've met so many people way more important than me. But when I first met you, I was so into what you were doing that every time I saw you, I wanted to give you a donation. You probably don't even remember this at all, but I always wanted to leave you with some money because I'm just like, this guy's going to be just great. Do you remember that?
I do remember that. You were very consistent and always making a donation to the causes. Fighting.
And then now though you're doing, you're giving money like you are Jedediah, like, you know, tell us about, you know, how you have done what I wish I can do more often, just giving money away.
It's a part of my life. I believe to stay blessed, you got to bless. And actually, I could not have imagined that my life would per se get to where it has gotten, especially financially. And so I just never forget where I come from. I've always been somebody that wanted to make a difference and make people's lives better or just make their day, and money helps. So I give when I can.
Now, I don't remember you being as strong as you look right now back in the day. It looks like you got down to Atlanta and Florida and just moved into a gym somewhere. So
I'm still working on it. I'm trying to gain 30 pounds, but you know, you got to have a beach body in Florida. You got to have a beach body. Yeah.
Apparently. All right. So let me ask you actually real quick. Let me ask you about you growing up. You grew up in Chicago, right?
Yeah.
So can you tell me about, because you have a profound calling on your life. You're just doing amazing things, but I'm sure growing up as a child, you know, you were running around some neighborhood. So tell me what it was like to be young, high school ages, Jedediah.
Actually, I think that I have a unique experience in the Midwest because I've always lived in, you know, Chicago. The Midwest is the only place that I've known, but I would be a young kid in the streets of Chicago, but my education was primarily in the south suburbs of Illinois. And so I would leave this more controlled, sheltered-like environment where people are pretty much concerned about their neighbors' children. The police are very much so accessible and involved in the schooling and the transportation of school to home and your parents. And then I would leave there and go to this kind of sort of chaotic environment where children were riding the CTA bus and police were not necessarily as attentive. Like going from the suburbs to Chicago every day, I got to see the best of the Midwest is what I'm trying to say. And so it kind of created this well-rounded view. I didn't have too much grit and much schooling. I kind of balanced it. And I got to see the difference between being in the suburbs where it's more family oriented. And then being in the city on the south side of Chicago, your means of survival is more gang oriented. So, I mean, it's kind of, I had a lot of duality. It was an amazing experience.
So when did you get the, because you, I remember, I know you were a pastor or are a pastor. When did you get the calling to become a, you know, priest or ministry?
Yeah, I was a pastor. I was a pastor for 10 years, far from it today, to be honest, just to like be completely honest. I'm not a pastor, you know, and I'm glad you said that because I'm going to try to find a church to go to this Sunday. I haven't been to church in a year, but I've always loved God. And I think that, again, the duality of life, I feel like there's a higher power. I know that a lot of things that I've gotten in life, I didn't get it by myself. And I've always loved God. So I grew up wanting to please God. And one of the ways that I wanted to please God was to spread his message. And I did that for 10 years, literally started it when I was like 15 years old. And I became a pastor somewhere around 20. And I was a pastor for 10 whole years. Wow.
people that are watching this are like, well, he looks like he's 18, 19, 21. I mean, nobody's going to believe that. But can you say how old you are? Or?
34. I'm going to be 35 this year. I'm excited.
People that are looking at this are like, no way he's that old. Like, he doesn't look like he's more than 21, 20. But I guess black on crack. But I don't know. But
Frank, you don't look at what they say about black.
Yeah, black on crack. You're right. You're right. So when did you, now, because I met you through a mentoring program, and then you came to my church and we talked, and you brought some amazing guests with you at the youth program. So then you got involved in youth work, and you're still doing some work with youth in the community around policing and whatever. What made you want to focus on the youth of Black youth?
Well, okay, so you're talking about, again, a time when I was in Chicago. I got into activism because I saw a 14-year-old shot. I saw him shot laying in the ground, dead, and I saw where the people around kind of sort of in a very morbid way, it was very weird because you saw the police scene, the tape go up, and then you saw the police tape move, and you saw people kind of go about as if there was not a child there. And I kind of grew a passion for trying to reach out to the young people at that point. I applaud the work that you've done with young people, and I love any invitation or any opportunity to try to make an impact on the future, because I believe that our decisions today is what will be their benefit or their disadvantage tomorrow. And so I had a passion growing for young people that kind of was birthed in advocacy, but also in the fact that as a young person, I often felt misunderstood. I didn't have anybody growing up that I felt knew how to reach me or how to really communicate with me. And so I wanted to be that for young people. So I think the word for me today is going to be duality. Growing up, not having a mentor, not having a father figure, and then seeing the carnage of lives being lost in Chicago made me passionate about children.
Okay. I'm getting to current situation with African Americans in Juneteenth. I just want the audience to see how, you know, great you are so they can see your credibility before I get there. So that's why, you know, I'm asking you all, like, why is he asking me all these questions? He knows this already, but I'm just trying to build the audience up to see how great you are. So back to Chicago real quick. I actually was sitting on my couch watching, I think with NBC. There was a Trump rally or something that was happening in Chicago. And I looked at some breaking news, and I was like, that looks familiar. He looks familiar. And I thought to myself, no, that's not, like, you know, it can't possibly be somebody that I know. And then I looked a little bit closer, and I think I saw Jedediah either being escorted out or something on the stage. I don't know what was happening. What was going on with that whole situation on that everybody in the news saw?
So you're talking about the Trump rally in Chicago at the UIC Pavilion. And for the record, I would say that because I know that the Cubs are involved, I applaud the Rickets because we've maintained a friendship beyond political parties. But Donald Trump was coming, I think it was 2016, to do a presidential speech in Chicago. And I had seen troubling things on the news as it related to what was going on at all the other rallies. And me just being true to the brand of fighting for Chicago, standing up for Chicago, I didn't want Chicago to be on the news having let some of those acts go on. So I went to the pavilion, no premeditated intent. And I felt like there was a lot of divisiveness, a lot of confusion, a lot of rhetoric that was troubling. And so when there were so many people who had came to the UIC Pavilion to kind of protest Donald Trump, I come there to make it, I wanted to make sure Chicago was basically safe and that our image on the news would be much, much different than what I've seen in other cities. And so I kind of bolted to the stage when they said that Donald Trump would not be coming out. And it was just kind of a magical moment, if you will. I felt led and I went. Literally just felt led and I went, jumped over the barricades, got up the stairs, got to the podium, and I'm screaming the best thing that can come to mind. After all of this adrenaline, I have no idea what I'm about to say. And I just say, America's already great without the hate. And that's that led to or was a part of one of the most iconic moments of the campaign for president for Donald Trump. And I became known as the guy who stopped Donald Trump from campaigning in Chicago.
And then you've been on CNN. How was that? How was that experience being on CNN?
At that point, that wasn't unusual because I was on CNN quite a bit. The beauty of the experience was not necessarily going on CNN because I've been on quite a bit of media outlets as an advocate. I think the most noteworthy experience in all of that was being contacted by foreign governments who were very concerned about what was going on in America. And believe it or not, offering me asylum if Donald Trump had won the election.
Wow.
Especially Justin in Canada. They were very adamant about if I had a problem, I could relocate to Canada and become a citizen.
Get a visa. Wow, that's definitely impressive. I'm going to get to the Cubs in 1 minute. I want to touch on one thing, though, because you said that I can touch on any topic I wanted, nothing off limits. But so when you're in Chicago, I was, again, minding my own business. I was watching something or doing something. And this time I got a bunch of text messages from people that I know that know you, that know that I know you, saying that you were about to commit suicide, about to die, something about to happen to you. I just blew it off because I know you. I'm like, this is just something that's not whatever. But and I know we all go through stuff. So was there anything that was, going on with you that made you want to, give up?
I lost the child that meant the world to me. His name is Travis Mensa. Technicality and bloody is my cousin, but I've kind of held him since he was a baby out of his mother's womb. And I've always been the only father he's ever known. So he's my son. And he transitioned, which done a great deal of damage to my family, hurt me very deeply. And I had a conversation with my family on that particular day by which they expressed some of the things that led up to why he had transitioned. And it devastated me. And unfortunately, I couldn't handle the grief at the moment. My world came crashing down. And simultaneously, I was visiting a girl in the hospital who was, I believe, shot and potentially transitioning. And I was rebuffed by the family, particularly another advocate who, in that space is often contentious, but that knucklehead wanted to kind of like lock arms and think that the motive for being there was wrong, be it that it was for money or publicity, which is absurd. And those events, as well as like losing things and just having a lot of pressure in life and the PTSD of advocating, I think it all took a toll at one time. And I ended up on Lakeshore Drive, ready to commit suicide, unfortunately.
And again, I have my moments as well. And I have, as my people that listen to the podcast know, I have sons of my own that I can relate to what you're saying. Yeah. All right, so the Cubs, you got invited to the Cubs and didn't come and see me because you didn't even know. I had never ever told you. I've known you throughout my entire life of knowing you. I never told you that I had worked for the Cubs for all those years. You never knew. So I can't get mad at you for not coming to find me. But you got invited to go to the Cubs game. Tell me about that invitation and that experience.
So first of all, I do want to say this, though. you know, there is life after those moments of wanting to give up. You just got to choose to live. And the story is so much greater on the other side of me not having committed suicide on Lakeshore Drive. And one of those things is the benefit or the beauty of being invited to the Cubs, to Wrigleyville, me invited to Wrigleyville, VIP status. Let me stun a little bit and put a little drip on that. I was invited to Wrigleyville by the Rickets themselves. And I got to see a game, which was my first time. And in the course of seeing it, I got to sit with the Rickets, hang out with them. And we talked about things that was going on in the city. And not only was that a visit that was free for me, but it led to what I would call a very prolific friendship with the Rickets. And I'm glad that I got that invitation. And that's also when I found out that you worked there. And I felt safe in the space.
Yeah, but, you know, I was going to say, you know, hey, you know, if you need some stuff or you need some help or you need, you know, our podcast to give out some hats or some tickets, or whatever, to let me know. But you don't even need that from me. You can just get it on your own. So, right.
I don't know. I would never ask for anything, but it was a blessing. Out of nowhere, too. They literally randomly reached out. And so I have a appreciation for the Ricky family because of how the hospitality that they've given.
Okay. Well, on a serious note, if you do, you know, come across some young people that want to go to a game or whatever, you know, hit me up and let me know on a serious note. And the podcast, we give out stuff so we can hook them up. And I was going to say when the Cubs come out to play the Braves in Atlanta, that I will come out and you can show me around, but I'm not going to anybody's gym and I'm not going to come out there and stand next to you and look, you know, like this. So
I motivate you, Frank. You might be in there.
I don't know. I think I'll just go to the Braves game and I'll just, you know, watch the game from there. All right. Let's talk about culture, race, and religion. It's, you know, Juneteenth. What does Juneteenth mean to you?
So I think that this is a very subjective conversation, and that's my view. Here it is, 2014, after what, 1854, the Emancipation Proclamation. People are celebrating, Black people are celebrating freedom, if you will, from slavery. But I would say that slavery has simply reorganized its presentation, that we're not necessarily as free as we should be. I think that the holiday is worth celebrating. It's a checkpoint for us, right? Started in Texas, and now I see it growing in my day where people are talking about actual Juneteenth celebrations, actual parades, actual cities putting proclamations and resolutions up. I think it's great, but I still think we got a long way to go, Frank. I think that freedom isn't free without the education, without the economics, and without the ability to rebuild the cultural fabric of our community. So I say we still got work to do. It's just a checkpoint, but it's definitely not the destination.
So what do you think about, you know, once the George Floyd thing happened and it became a national, got national attention, then companies started making Juneteenth a paid holiday for their staff. So what do you think about the whole George Floyd influence on now corporations and everybody celebrating their Juneteenth sales now at stores?
I have a friend in Chicago, Kira Mo. She's going to be doing a huge Juneteenth parade throughout the city of Chicago. And she got sponsors galore. And I'll say this, sponsorship and paid holidays, again, those are great. These are moments and steps of progress. We got to celebrate it. But George Floyd is not an isolating incident. That is still the reality of being Black in America. You know, the reaction is good. But it is what the quality of life and the proactive steps that we should really be focusing on. And America just hasn't gotten there yet. I think we're starting to talk about reparations in a real serious way. I think we're starting to hear people talk about Black people being affluent and having those roles and those people who are in those roles feeling free to actually reach out to people who would aspire to have them. I feel like we're in the middle, and it is the most beautiful thing that I've ever seen, because we're starting to see the conversation go in a way by which we can actually become part of the architecture of what freedom and being Black in America is. And so we're on a good track. So I don't want to be a downer, but I just want to be clear. We got a lot of work to do, and it's way more than some paid day off or a little holiday check.
You know, so for the majority of you all that are listening to us on a podcast, either on Spotify or Apple or Pandora or iHeartRadio, all the places that we are. So you're able to hear this this Baptist type voice that he has. And, you know, that when I first met him, it was a voice that like, wow, this man has a voice. You know, Obama has that kind of, you know, that voice too. But so this next question is going to sound great coming from you when that preacher voice that you have. So my question to you is, looking at how we just talked about Juneteenth, but America overall, what if you had to give a state of the union of where we are now overall, what would your state of the union? How is the union? How is the country right now?
Well, that is a pretty hard question. It's probably, I feel like I've been interviewed by some of the best, and that would probably be the hardest question that I've ever done. Period. You got that, Frank. You got that. And the Baptist voice is funny. I do have an impression of Obama. I can't conjure it up right now, but I am going to try to check. But honestly, I would say that if I was to give a state of the union, I would say that the resolve of America, which is something that has always been sang about and talked about, is still there. The resolve. And that's the resolve to pray through all of our challenges, which no matter what side of the aisle you're on, everybody's still going. Everybody's still pressing towards the same thing, life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness. And so I would say specifically as it relates to Juneteenth, I'm the consciousness is rising and it needs to continue to rise for white people, our counterparts that are white and yellow, red, you know, whatever the color is, outside of being black and brown, which is the most talked about in the marginalized sense, is that they have to understand that black, that the minority assertion for a better quality of life is not an attack or an intent to destroy or dismantle every other quality of life that there is. It's not a fight for privilege. It's a fight for equality. And so I would say to America, keep going, keep thriving. It's beautiful. It's difficult. It's hard. But because of our resolve, we're getting ready to reshape what life looks like for the next era, for the next generation. And we actually get to choose. We have technology, information, and the connectedness that the world didn't have, you know, decades and centuries ago. We can do things today that most people would not have even dreamed of. And so I would say to America, no matter who the president is, no matter what neighborhood they live in, no matter the status economically, educationally, keep the resolve that we have tells me we're going to get there. Everybody is in the marathon pressing. And I believe Dr. King's dream, although not yet a full reality, is starting to become a real possibility. And I hope I get to live to see it.
Okay, let's talk about a little bit about some of the social unrest that took place last summer. As our listeners know, I've talked about this already, and I've said that, you know, there are, in my opinion, there are many, many different ways to attack an issue, not just one. I didn't go out on the street and whatever, only because I'm just not going to do that. It's just not my thing. But I chose to go a different route. You know, I was able to. I was lucky enough to learn how to invest at an early age, which allowed me to start retirement at the age of 40 and whatever. So my response was that I was going to teach young Black people how to invest, how to read the market. And I'm still doing that to this day. I teach about 100 young people a year how to invest, how to understand the market. And that was my way of giving back to the community. I just feel like if we know what assets are and you know how to deal with capitalism and the stock market, then we can start to compete and not rely on anybody else. But what did you do when the social unrest was going on, and what do you think about all that?
I think that everybody has a part to play. I've learned that everyone is not going to have the same functionality. So your part is actually one of the most powerful and profound. You got to be able to invest so that my part was shifting during these times. it started out with the marching and the protesting. I did miss the looting. No, I'm just playing. I don't necessarily, I don't condone the criminality, but I understand it. And I ain't gonna lie. I've seen some of the things that people got, and I'm just like, man, I wish that I could have had some of that. And I didn't even buy any of it in the hood when it came, it was resold. But I would say that I started out with the marching and the protesting, which its only purpose is awareness. It's just so that people can actually know that it's happening. And now my place is similar to yours, believe it or not. And I'm saying this out of my mouth, believe it or not. And I don't lie. God has blessed me to be on a track to where I'm going to be a multimillionaire if I keep on going, and it won't be very long. And so I'm taking these unique opportunities that I've been given, and I am now helping people to buy businesses, to invest in businesses. I'm trying to teach people how to, you know, get in stock. I am one of those cryptocurrency babies, as well as, you know, trying to live my best life and do what we talked about earlier. I am a giver consistently. Today, I gave away money just out there. I don't always film it anymore like I used to, but my role has shifted. I'm 34 years old. I'm not old, but I guarantee you my marching days, I don't march that much. But we do need the people to march.
So before I move on, two quick things. One, just because I have not talked to you in years doesn't mean I'm not following, keeping up with you. And I definitely know financially you are blessed and highly favored. So that I know for sure. And then two, if you're listening to this and you are a person of color or anybody actually, you're young, you want to know how to invest with just what the terms are and the definitions are, on my YouTube channel, I got a show called Frank and Friends that teach you how to invest from $1 all the way through, so you can learn it as a beginner. And so go check that out if you want to learn how to invest. All right, so I didn't learn about Juneteenth until I was in my 30s. I did not learn about it in school at all. But another thing I did not learn about in school was Black Wall Street and the Tulsa situation. When did you learn about these things? Did you learn about it in school, or did you learn about it on your own after school?
Honestly, I did learn about the Black Wall Street and the Tulsa, Oklahoma situation while I believe eighth grade. I was profoundly impacted by that. I was actually a social studies buff. I love social studies, my favorite subject. That lunch, didn't miss lunch. And I definitely was intrigued and I paid attention to social studies. So yeah, I learned it then.
So can you break down for people that don't have any idea about Black Wall Street and Tulsa, can you break down in the simplest terms, like, you know, what it was about in a nutshell?
There was a time where Black commerce was thriving. And because of the segregation and the way that the world thought, or at least America, Black people were more so going to Black people. And because of it, we were thriving in our business districts, and the whole towns were created of Black people thriving. And it was bombed by the government. I mean, is that a good enough explanation? It was It was bombed by a government hatefully because at that time, the Black prosperity was not favored. It was not something that was a really favored. So,
yes, and for those of you that are participating, right after this is over, you're going to be seeing actually a small little quick documentary on Black Wall Street immediately following this. You'll be able to see more into that. But so the Black Wall Street thing, you know, that's another thing that really inspired me to teach people about money. I feel like we're just getting money, spending money in the wrong places, and still in this cycle of poverty. But if we can start owning some stuff and putting some money back into where we come from, we can all be on this even path together and living in harmony, which is the ultimate goal, which is what I believe. I believe money is more important than we're willing to give credit to. I think it's really important to have money.
They say the answer is all things. Now, there go my Baptist moment. Money answers all things, but it is the love of money that is the root of evil. It is when money is more important than humanity. That's when we get off track. But if you think you're going to make a difference without money, keep on living, as my grandmother would say.
Now, recently, let's move to recent time. So I've seen you, again, just because I don't talk to you does not mean I have this philosophy, and everybody knows, and that is to keep people around me who are smarter than me, regardless of what my age is. Keep people around me that are smarter than me that I can get to when I need to. So, I keep Jedediah as one of those people that social media alerts me of when they post. There's six people in the world that, Facebook knows when you can select that. When these people post, you need to let me know when they post. And one of them is Jedediah. So I always know what's going on. One thing I noticed that you post a lot about the police when you go certain places, whether it's Miami or Atlanta or whatever. So tell me, what is your, what is your current stance on policing in America? Because I know you post a lot about that.
I do auxiliary policing as a job, which is very interesting because I know the power of wearing a uniform and the power to being able to keep an area under control, I guess, if you will, in a safe manner or in a oppressive manner. And so I think that policing is what it has always been. And I think that it is a system or a tool of oppression or a tool of upliftment, depending on who the powers that be or the policies that govern that particular region. And so I've always been focusing on police. I've always watched them. I've always considered the policies and what they do, because I believe that is the that is the front line for us. And so my stance on policing has evolved, because there are good officers. All police officers aren't bad, and the experience is individual based, but the system overall has a lot of work to do as it relates to accountability, as it relates to education and training, and as it relates to hiring and assignments. And so, again, it's that same conversation as the Juneteenth conversation. We got a lot of work to do. We got some progress. We've seen officers be prosecuted. We've never seen that before. Derek from George Floyd's situation, but are we where we need to be? No. And so I do watch the police a lot, and I'll just continue to see how that evolves. And when I wear my uniform, I wear it based on the value systems that I've always fought for, just to watch, to serve, and to protect.
Okay. So I'm going to move to a lighter note, because you had invited me, and again, I keep saying this, you might not remember this because you know so many people, but you may remember this or not, but you invited me to an event at the Cultural Center for Steve Harvey's mentoring program. And my first time meeting you, you invited me to the event, and you had on a tie. I think I asked you for the tie. Can I have that tie? And you said no. No, you said yes, but you didn't give it to me. But anyway, you probably don't remember that at all, but you still have some tie. I was like, let me want that tie. But we walked into this meeting or whatever, and something happened. You walked into the room, and everything sort of like, my God, Jedediah is here. Like, and I had always experienced that with me, but I had never experienced me walking behind somebody. And when they walk into the room, everybody knows, acknowledges he has Jedediah with a smile and the whatever, and everybody's like, Jedediah is here. I'm just like, I had never, ever experienced that at all. And you were in the zone, you were in the mood, you were, so I want to move from advocacy to some fun stuff. I want everybody to see that Jedediah personality, that smile, that just like, that captures rooms. So I want to talk about, you recently went to Miami, and I want to know about what are some things that you discovered or had fun doing in Miami that people should check out when they go to Miami.
Have you ready for I'm going to tell you.
Yes.
Because I'm here right now. First of all, the weather is always amazing for the most part. Everybody comes here. I feel like this is just there are two times when people work their hardest on their bodies, when their birthday is coming and when they're finna take to Miami. And so you see all of the beauty that's here as it relates to people, it's vacation, but there's this life, this amount of joy that's coming out where people are not necessarily judging each other. And it's just do whatever you want to do to have fun. It's very expensive though, I had a $15 cheeseburger, and I swear I'm still mad that I had that cheeseburger. But I just love the diversity here. There's a lot of Spanish culture. There is, like I said, the beach. But more so for me, Miami is an escape. I work so hard in Atlanta. Of course, I just recently visited Chicago, and there's tons of work when I got there. Even when I hit the ground, there was so much work that I did behind the scenes in Chicago, having Chicago recently had the murder of Lil Durk's brother. That was pretty intense, a pretty intense moment. But then I came right here to Miami after a quick stop in New York, and I'm not gloating, but that's really my life now, and I love it. And it's just like I escape. None of those troubles matter. You see the palm tree and the smoothies, and I just love it. You know, so the most dangerous thing that I've encountered here are the lizards, the geckos that run very fast across my feet and make me almost trip and bust my head, or the alligators. I love it.
What about the food? You come from Chicago, you know, we have greens and cornbread, and what about the food in Miami? I mean,
you should have. Anybody who's on here from Florida, I just got to tell you, you can't cook. However, the best food is still hands down in Chicago. When I just went to Chicago, I wanted the soul food because Atlanta doesn't have it, New York doesn't have it, Florida doesn't have it. But I missed our food so much, I had to start at the basics, get back to getting a pizza puff and Italian beef when I went to
Chicago. God, those are my two favorites.
Find it here, and it is the most nerve-wracking thing. But yeah, no, the food I don't want to talk about because it ain't that great.
Yeah, okay.
They're at the gym, Frank. They're not cooking. They're not taking cooking classes. They're working out.
I see. So what is the beach life like? Like, you just get up and put on some shorts and head to the beach and just like what is the beach life like? I mean,
loose clothes. Oh my God, Frank. I want to get outside. As soon as it's over, I'm going right to the beach. But it is amazing. I will say the breeze. I don't even have hair, but I love the breeze. Imagination. And the watching the waves, listening to the waves, enjoying the sand, watching the families have fun. I don't swim, but I let my feet go as far as the waves start hitting my kneecaps, then I back up. It's amazing. And I think that this is going to be the place that I land. Because it is definitely retirement vibes and vacation vibes. I love it. It's just amazing. The beach life. Oh, and I've enjoyed the caramelizing. So I don't want to sound ignorant, but let me just say, I didn't know that Black people tan, but
me either.
Black people tan. I've tanned, and I've enjoyed the consistency of my skin complexion.
Now, I've never asked you for anything, so you know it's about to come next, but I've never asked you for anything, but I'm going to ask you right now, because I would love for our people here in Chicago, you don't have to do it now, but can you, when you do go out at some point and you're out on the beach, can you film some stuff for us and send it to me so that I can show our staff and our video watchers life on the beach with Jedediah?
I would definitely do that. I just went to Honolulu Park, which is the new beach. I posted those and Facebook took them down. So I won't be some of those other ones for you, all right?
Yes. Now, so I counted it, and it has been 11 years since we last talked and spoke. This is a long time. So I do this with my guests that I haven't talked to in a while, because things have changed in 11 years. Do you have any questions for me?
Any questions for you? No, not questions, more applause. I thank God for your consistency. I'm glad Chicago still has you. You're looking great, Frank. You're looking great. They're not stressing you out enough in Chicago.
No, they're not.
And no, man, I just hope that, you know, I'll have an opportunity to come back and give more updates at the show. But I'm good. Good to see you.
Yes, if anybody in the world should have their own podcast, it is Jedediah. I mean, I don't know why you don't have one. I mean, I'm going to probably try to get you to be on a podcast network with me one day, but, you need a podcast.
humbling.
The world needs to hear what you have to say, and
don't butter me up the wrong way. Don't have me getting brave thinking that I can do that.
If I can do it, you can do it. Trust me. trust me. All right, but I'm gonna let you get back out to the world out there, and I've already got my ask, and the world heard him say yes. He's gonna film some stuff for us to see the beach life out there in Miami. But thank you so much, Jedediah. The hardest, even when I did know you, you were the hardest person in the world to catch. You always made time for me when I needed something back then, and you did so for today. So I totally appreciate you. You know, if you need something from me, if I can do it, let me know. I'm always striving to be more and more like you every day. And you know, I wish you the best. You always have a friend in me.
That's awesome. And likewise, for sure.
All right. So thank you all for participating. Remember, go ahead and go to the show notes if you're traveling. If you want to go to Miami, if you travel like Jedediah, he doesn't need the discount. But the rest of you that want a discount like me, go down to the show notes, use that code when you buy your flights and whatever, and get some cup hats and some jerseys and things that we're giving away. Go down there and check all that out. And I will see you all in the next edition of the podcast. Thank you all, everybody.
Let's be clear here. I still like this. If you catch me in the comment section getting that devil them codes.
All right.
Something terrible happened here. And for decades, people didn't talk about it.
I was an adult before I ever heard about it. It was something that was hidden.
This entire historic community was obliterated.
Bodies dumped in rivers, bodies dumped in mass graves. It was an absolute massacre.
This story isn't one you'll find in most history books. And almost 100 years later, the facts of what exactly happened that day are still unraveling.
So we're driving in what's known as Black Wall Street. It's where one of the nation's worst episodes of racial violence took place.
In 1921, a neighborhood in Tulsa, Oklahoma, called the Greenwood District, was a bustling community of black-owned businesses. Tulsa locals know that period of Greenwood's history as a kind of golden age.
If you can imagine just a like an old-time downtown, things like movie theaters, pharmacies, hair salons, and so forth.
They called it Black Wall Street.
It was a mecca. It was a huge success.
But Black Wall Street was also an anomaly. It thrived at a time when the KKK was incredibly active in Oklahoma, and the nation had just been through the Red Summer of 1919, when white mobs murdered black people in dozens of incidents across the U.S.
There needed to be a sort of match or an igniter tossed on these embers. And that event was, that trigger event, was an incident that involved two teenagers. Dick Rowland, 19-year-old black boy who shined shoes downtown. Sarah Page, 17-year-old white girl who ran an elevator in a downtown building called the Drexel Building. He went to the building, boarded the elevator. Something happened, and Sarah Page began to scream. They both ran out of the elevator.
Now, we don't know exactly what happened in this elevator. But a day later, Rowland was arrested and taken to the courthouse. The local newspaper ran an article claiming Rowland had assaulted Page. Even though Page refused to press charges, the article was essentially a call to action for whites.
A large white mob began to gather on the lawn of the courthouse. Dick Rowland was in jail on the top floor. A number of black men, several dozen, marched down to the courthouse to protect him, some of them armed. There was a struggle between one of the black men in the small group and one of the white men in the larger group, and things sort of went south from that point.
Hundreds of white people descended upon Black Wall Street, armed. Black residents withdrew behind the railroad tracks that marked off the Greenwood District. Some of them were armed and fought back, but they were outnumbered by the white mob, which shot their way through. The white mob murdered They looted and they set fire to Black Wall Street.
This was the strategy, if you will, of how to deal with these communities, with these successful Black communities. The effects were disastrous.
For 2 days, the Greenwood District burned. Martial law was declared, and the National Guard was brought in. By the time the massacre ended, Greenwood was in ruins. More than 1,200 homes were destroyed, and 35 blocks burned. The exact number of casualties is harder to pin down. Some initially only reported that white people died. Others reported somewhere between 30 and 100 mostly Black casualties. But estimates now put that number closer to 300. As for those that survived, thousands of them lived in tent cities in the months that followed and were left to pick up the pieces of rubble they once called home. After the massacre, the cover-up started. Records went missing from city files, including the very article that started it all. It makes photos from this time all the more important as part of the historical record, but back in 1921, these images served a very different purpose.
So photo postcards like these were pretty widely distributed after the massacre. At the time, they were a part of white supremacist culture and kept as souvenirs of racially charged crimes.
Now they're preserved to make sure this part of Tulsa's history isn't forgotten, and they paint a clear picture of how much destruction there was that day. On the postcards, it's called the Tulsa Race Riot, a name that itself sort of erases what really happened.
By calling it a riot, it's a way of trying to rewrite the history, assuming that there were both sides at fault, and that was not the case. I call it a massacre, and I call it that because that's what it was.
Greenwood eventually rebuilt, but nearly a century later, there's a part of this story that still haunts the city. No one actually knows where the victims' bodies are.
We got to find our people. We got to put them at rest. You know, if not, we continue to be haunted by what was done so many years ago.
Kevin Ross, a local writer, is one of many in Tulsa descended from people who lost everything in the massacre.
So in this cemetery, there are only two official victims of the Tulsa Race Massacre. Right. How many victims do you think there are?
After all these years, I think 300 is putting it mild.
In 1997, the city finally put together a commission to study the massacre and help piece together what happened in 1921. They compiled records and eyewitness accounts.
Bullets were just raining down over us.
They set our house on fire and went right straight to the curtains and set the curtains on fire.
These accounts are especially important now, because none of these survivors are alive anymore. And they also provided new information. Some mentioned trucks, like this one, loaded with victims of the riot. One riot witness in particular came forth testifying that he saw bodies being dumped in Oaklawn Cemetery.
This is it. This is the area.
Using the survivor accounts, records, and eventually radar, the city was able to pinpoint three locations with anomalies in the soil. Only one step was left, to excavate. But it was something the city, at the time, wasn't up for doing. For many Tulsans, it was a part of history best forgotten, and not worth investigating. In some ways, today, that sentiment remains.
Kind of waste of money.
Why do you think that?
It's over, it's done.
But there are clear signs of a city that's ready to come to terms with a dark chapter in its history.
Honestly, that's a lot of missing people, people that probably had families.
We owe it to the people whose blood has actually fertilized the grounds of this place.
There was a tremendous amount of racism.
Injustice plus time does not equal justice.
Today, a new mayor is reopening the investigation.
I think a pretty basic compact that a city makes with its citizens is, if somebody murders you, we will do everything we can to find out what happened to you and give your family closure. And whether you were murdered yesterday or you were murdered 98 years ago.
The city will be looking into the three areas that the commission noted. That process of finding out what lies beneath Tulsa and DNA matching any remains with descendants could take years. The investigation is just one part of a bigger historical reckoning, but the reality is it can't undo the crimes or the cover-up of the 1921 Tulsa Race Massacre.
This story is the greatest conspiracy of silence that I've ever seen in history.
Hey everybody, Joe Flaherty here with the Mistaken Identity Podcast. We hope you enjoyed this week's episode. We want to thank you for your continued support. We also want to extend a heartfelt thank you to those of you who have written reviews, dropped some likes, and shared our shows, as that has allowed us to grow beyond any of our expectations. As a matter of fact, we're excited to announce a new way for our loyal listeners to enhance their experience even more with our new membership feature. All you have to do is jump in the show notes and follow the link to our Patreon page, where you can find access to a whole bunch of extra goodies for as little as $3 a month. You'll be given access to exclusive content, merchandise, behind-the-scenes video, early access to episodes, the ability to make special requests for guests, and much, much more. Now, if that sounds like something that interests you, head on over to Patreon and search Mistaken Identity Podcast, or simply follow the link in our show notes to join the likes of Nancy Sullivan, Alice Daniels, and Kathy Chester at the rookie level, all the way on up to the Hall of Fame level with longtime listeners Kathy Weedley and Kathy Grossman. As always, we can't leave without our disclaimer. The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are solely our own, and we do not speak for or on behalf of the Chicago Cubs or any other organization. Stay safe, and we'll catch you next time.